If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Damon Sharonis, always here to break down all these news stories. He is the founder of Sharonis and Parente. He's aggressive, passionate, highly skilled advocate for people charged with serious problems. If I had a problem, yes, Damon would be the one I would call. Damon, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Karen. How are you doing?
Are you on the
waiting for you to get arrested?
Okay, yeah. Well, are you looking? You're looking forward to me being arrested so I can call you.
Well, you said you call. Yeah, no, I'm joking.
No, I know you're joking. You're just you like me for my retainer. Is that fair to say?
Of course.
Anyway, let's get started. I want to talk about Dr. Anthony Fauci. I'm kind of feeling sorry for him. He's, you know, the face of COVID response. He's before a Senate committee. He's being asked questions about stuff that happened 5-6 years ago. He was pardoned by President Biden on the last day of office, and he is now taking the Fifth Amendment 111 times. What do you make of this, and do you think that he has a right to take the Fifth Amendment?
Absolutely, he has a right. You know, people hear that somebody takes the Fifth and they think that they're automatically guilty. That is not what the Fifth Amendment means. Innocent people can put it forth as well. You know, it's a very important protection we have. You know, it protects you from compelled testimony that could be the link in the chain to evidence. And you have to remember, the only pardon that he received was a federal pardon. So, ostensibly, there could be state charges, there could be prosecutions for different crimes, there could be, you know, false statement, obstruction charges. And if he would have said anything, you can bet that somebody would have convened a jury and tried to charge him with something. So he had an absolute right to raise it. And, you know, that's what I would have advised him to do if I were in his lawyer's shoes.
And there's talk that they're going to hold him in contempt or attempt to hold him in contempt. If they do that, how would that work? I mean, they're not in court. They're in a senatorial hearing. Is there a contempt of Senate type of law?
Sure. Judge would have to make a decision. I'm not exactly sure how it works when you testify before the Senate. They'd have to take him to sort of, I think, the chief judge of that district. And there would have to be a determination made that there is no potential liability, right? Because that happens sometimes. It'll happen in cases I've been involved in where somebody will plead the Fifth, and then you'll have to have a meeting, usually behind closed doors, with the chief judge and sort of make a proffer as to what the defense attorney believes the issues are. Now, if there is pleading, essentially, that he does not have a Fifth Amendment privilege, which I don't think would happen in this case, and he is compelled to testify and he doesn't, he could be then held in contempt. I don't expect that to happen in this case, but that would be sort of the procedural mechanism that goes into forcing someone to testify if they do not have a true Fifth Amendment privilege.
Got it.
You know, one of the accusations levied by Rand Paul, the senator who is spearheading these attacks against Anthony Fauci, is that he misled the country and really sort of steered them away from the possibility that the COVID virus came out of Wuhan and came out of a lab. And my question is, you know, if I were a journalist in that room back then in the White House, when there was hesitancy amongst the medical professionals, amongst White House, those in power to sort of point the finger based on cultural pressures from outside, specifically this reluctance to point the finger at people of color, there was a strong sense that if you were calling out anybody, there was an Asian component to it. If you were a racist, you couldn't say it came from a lab. You could allude to the fact that maybe it came from the wet markets, but if there was any sort of cultural attachment to it, you were branded a bigot or a racist. My question to you is there anything, you know, Rand Paul is saying to, you know, ostensibly saying to Fauci, you misled the country about the potential origins. There was pressure, again, culturally, because people were saying this is wrong. You're pointing a finger at a culture. Does an attorney have an argument there on Fauci's behalf to say, of course he was hesitant to say it came from a specific area or a place within China?
I think that fall.
Damon, we're getting a really bad, we're getting a really bad reception here. Can you try it again? And if not, we're going to probably take a break, see if you can situate somewhere else. Go ahead, try it again.
Can you hear me?
It's not good. Yep. One more time.
Okay, hold on, let me. Yeah, can you hear me now?
It's a little better.
Okay, so in any false statement case, the issue, the truth is sort of what the truth is. And if they establish false statements, you couldn't have excuse for it. The issue here is whether a false statement was made. In other words, if you knew it came from China and you lied about that, the fact that there was a defense. So I think that might answer your question. As his lawyer, I may argue never made a false statement, and there were certainly some overarching issues at play when he was making his statements.
We're going to take a break, and we're going to try to get this audio a little bit better because it's hard to understand. Let's take a break now. You're listening to WGN. We're talking to Damon Schroenis here with Scott Schneider on WGN.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Okay, let's talk about the Idaho murder defendant, Brian Koberger. He pled guilty last year of killing four college students. That was a case that was followed internationally. He now claims he's going to seek to have his plea deal vacated. Now, when he pled guilty, my understanding was that he waived his right to appeal. Can you explain to our listeners what he's going to do if not appeal?
So he waived his right to appeal, which is not surprising in a case like this when the government is conferring a benefit, in this case, to take the death penalty off the table. But what you normally cannot waive are your post-conviction rights, like your right to have an effective assistance of counsel or to make sure that your plea was voluntary. So he's left with arguing, essentially, that either his plea was involuntary or his lawyers did something that was so below the standard and it affected his ability to make a knowing and voluntary plea of guilty.
Now, Damon, you have handled ineffective assistance of counsel appeals, as have I. Have you ever been successful on one of them?
Well, I did actually once convince a district court judge to take back somebody's plea of guilty in federal court because the initial lawyer did not advise them of their immigration consequences. But it's an uphill battle. In a situation like this, you have to really point to some specific evidence. And I read up on what he is claiming. I think he's saying, like, they did not tell him how they said death row was worse than it really is. And there's some issue about it, chain of custody regarding the knife. But at the end of the day, the plea colloquy in this case was so thorough that it's going to be very difficult for something like that to rise to that level.
And I assume it would matter that his lawyer was a very seasoned prosecutor first, and then she's a defense lawyer. She was a public defender, and she really, it sounds like she did a great job and was well respected. Does that factor in as well?
Yeah, for a lot of reasons. Let's say this went to a hearing, right? And his lawyer would be able to testify because by filing this claim, he is waiving attorney-client privilege. So then it might become a credibility determination between this well-regarded, well-experienced lawyer and the guy who admitted to murdering people and, you know, admitted to doing it in court. So, yes, it does matter that his lawyer is well-versed in what she does.
And I would imagine, too, the fact that Koberger was a PhD candidate in, of all things, criminal justice, when he's being asked by the judge, are you making this plea voluntarily? Do you understand what you're giving up? Do you understand that you have a right to a jury trial? You know, and he's nodding and he's saying yes. I mean, he's a smart guy. Does that factor in, too?
Again, if you went to a hearing and he was cross-examined on those questions, absolutely. Some individuals have raised issues regarding their mental health or their IQ level or those types of things when they're claiming a plea was not knowing and voluntary or they didn't understand what their lawyer said. So the opposite would be true. Somebody who is intelligent, somebody who has experience with the law and criminal justice, I think would have a higher hurdle to convince a court that he wasn't aware of what was going on.
Now, let's just say in the unlikely event of him getting a new trial, which I think, you know, you would agree with me is pretty slim, right?
Yeah, it seems like it. It seems like this is sort of a ploy, to either get back in the media or maybe he's just tired of being in prison and he wants, you know, to potentially face the death penalty. You know, who knows?
Well, and that's what my question was going to be. If he gets a new trial, don't you think the prosecutors are going to put the death penalty right back on the table?
Without a doubt, absolutely. All bets are off and he starts back from the beginning. And I think the prosecutors have already come out and said, as have some of the family members who I think were a little upset that he wasn't facing the death penalty. You know, it's one of those, be careful what you wish for. And I've said that to clients as well. Look, if you're taking back a plea, you're starting from square one. And sometimes charges have been dismissed or you've gotten some sort of benefit. But the state of Idaho would absolutely proceed on the death penalty.
And one of the things that I have seen is that defendants and convicted felons like Koberger, who is facing maybe, you know, he could have 60 years in his little cage. You know, it's monotonous. Every day's the same. There's nothing to do. And so these people love to file appeals. They love to file civil lawsuits. It gives them something to do and something to work for. And my guess is that he did not have any clue how bad this was going to be for him. And, you know, I understand he's locked down 23 hours a day for his own protection. When he's released, he's actually released into a cage. So he's not, doesn't have any, interaction with anyone. You know, Damon, you've visited prisons for years, visiting inmates. A person like him, convicted of those types of crimes, how does he fare in prison, in lockup? How do they usually do?
I would say a high-profile case like this where college students were murdered, he's not very popular, you know, amongst the other inmates to the extent that he has any type of relations with them. I heard he's been, you know, sort of haunted on a daily basis. So no, he's not somebody that would do well in general population. He is somebody that would probably have a mark on his back.
Damon, why don't you give it your contact information? Damon Sharonis is he's a founder of Sharonis and Parente here in Chicago. Why don't you give out your contact?
Sure. Best way to get a hold of me is just find me on my website, which is www.sharonislaw.com.
Let's talk about the Georgia father of school shooter who was sentenced this week. His father, Colin Gray, gifted his 14-year-old son an assault rifle that the teenager then used to execute a mass shooting. I think two students and two teachers were killed. There may have been others wounded. The father was convicted of second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. Can you remind us, Damon, when a parent is criminally responsible for the criminal acts of his child?
To speak in just sort of regular terms, when the parents are on notice of somebody's violent behavior, and especially in this case, when they sort of facilitate it by arming them, and that is sort of them acting recklessly. It's not enough that your child, God forbid, goes out and does something out of the blue. You know, as a good parent, you wouldn't know that that was going to happen. But in a case like this, there were red flags everywhere, and parents have to be responsible for those red flags. And, you know, there was a shrine in his house to past school shooters, and they saw all of these sort of incremental steps that would lead somebody to believe he was going to do something like this. So it's when parents have a reasonable belief that something could happen and they miss those red flags or they ignore them.
So let me ask you this. You know, we look at the Crumbleys and the Oxford school shooting, okay, and that was a landmark case because this young man had mental health issues. It's well documented. They apparently, you know, ostensibly ignored them. They were found guilty 10 to 15 years each. Given we know there's been so many widespread documentation of young people who were really damaged by the pandemic. How concerned are you as a lawyer that there could be, you know, given the proliferation of gun ownership, especially since the pandemic, that there could be a lot of troubled youth out there? I mean, parents can't be everywhere all the time, that could, you know, bring a gun to school and there could be signs of, you know, trouble. And the parents could be, you know, hauled into court, and maybe they don't realize the depth of their children's distress.
Well, it's every parent's worst nightmare. I think, you know, good parents who have a handle on their children are going to see some warning signs. And the first rule is don't arm your children in those situations, right? That's a pretty easy sort of way to look at things. But I think the prosecutors for the most part, prosecutors' offices would look at these cases and do their jobs, right, and determine if they really believe that the type of case that deserves criminal prosecution. And, you know, if not, then they're defensible, right? These are defensible cases depending on the facts. So I think prosecutors are trying to send a message here. They're trying to let parents know nothing is working in this country because of the mass shootings at school. So we are going to start holding parents responsible. Maybe that will send the message that they have to do more. I think that's what they're really doing with these cases.
And prosecutors are allowed to do that, right? I think a lot of people think that the prosecutors can't hold up high-profile cases as examples. But that's part of the decision to prosecute, is it not?
One of the banners of prosecutors' offices is to deter future criminal conduct. In federal court, deterrence, both general and specific, is a statutorily directed part of sentencing. So, yes, you know, they can send messages because their job is to protect the community. And one of the ways to do that is by notifying the community, if you do this, you are going to be prosecuted.
And I will note, in case we haven't made it abundantly clear, in both the Crumbly case in Michigan and this case in Georgia, the facts are egregious. I mean, they are really egregious here against the parents, in my view. So if anyone wants to look at those facts and say to yourself, if you were a parent, would you have been supplying a gun to this kid? You know,
100%.
So let's talk quickly about the Broadview 6. Your firm represented one of the Broadview 6. First, tell us again, it's been in the news for months. Tell us who the Broadview 6 were, what happened, and I want to ask you kind of a follow-up about what's going on today.
Sure. The Broadview 6 were individuals who were protesting at the ICE detention center in Broadview. They were all somewhat politically connected in the Democratic Party. They were charged with essentially assaulting a federal officer. They were indicted felony conspiracy charges. We were able to secure a dismissal of those charges by getting to the grand jury transcripts, where it became very apparent that the prosecutor who was handling that case committed misconduct by vouching for the case, by having conversations with grand jurors off the record, just a whole sort of slew of things that should not be done in a grand jury. That's the brief synopsis.
So now what's next? Are there allegations that the Broadview 6 are going to try to get their legal fees paid? Is the judge going to refer any of the lawyers involved to our licensing commission? What's next?
So we're sort of in a holding pattern. We are all the defense attorneys and the clients are in negotiations to attempt to get legal fees paid for, because these individuals had to pay for lawyers. There's also been requests made that the court conduct hearings, sanctions hearings, to determine the scope of the misconduct. We've requested potentially a special prosecutor be assigned. So there's a lot of things that have not been decided yet, but the case is very much live. And, you know, our team and the team of the other lawyers are really pushing forward to try to get a hearing in court to where people will have to answer these questions.
And
what happened?
I'm not sure if this is at all related, but our news station, our news people just reported that charges were dropped in the Washington, D.C. case against the man who put his hand in the reflecting pool. He was charged with felony, some sort of felony damage, criminal damage. It had to be over $1,000 in damage. And apparently there was no evidence that he caused the damage or that the damage was over $1,000 to repair. There seems to be a walking back from the prosecution and a walking back that what happened in the grand jury may not have been appropriate. I don't think we know all the facts yet, but do you see this as a trend with prosecutors across the country? Because, Damon, I mean, I've practiced law for 40 years, and prosecutors in the federal realm are pretty honest and pretty good about what they do. And I'm seeing them make mistakes, if I can say that in the nicest of ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening, right? You know, I had a case that I was hired on maybe a week after the Broadview case was dismissed, and it was the same prosecutor, different type of case, and I was able to get that case dismissed too. What people are saying, and I think it's a great quote, they're saying ready, fire, aim is what some of these prosecutors are doing,
yeah,
right? As opposed to aiming and then firing, because when you indict somebody, you completely throw their world up for grabs. Right? You've represented people under indictment. Judges and prosecutors don't really realize the extent of the pain and suffering that individuals charged with crimes go through. And that's one of the many reasons prosecutors need to be very diligent in determining whether or not a crime has been committed. In the Reflecting Pool case, now there's evidence that it was like how it was built, right? I mean, it was like
right.
And some poor guy in a canoe gets arrested and indicted, right? Where did he go to get his reputation back? I mean, it's ridiculous. So, yeah, that's happening a lot more than it should.
Absolutely. Damon, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you taking time out of your August Sunday. Can you give our listeners your contact information? If anyone has any legal issues that are criminal in nature, Damon's the guy.
Thank you, Karen. Again, it's www.CheronisLaw.com. That will give you links to me, my partner, Chris Parenti, and the firm.
Thank you so much. Join us again soon.
All right. Thanks, Karen. Take care.